Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and we are at the International Students for Liberty Conference in Washington, D.C., and we are talking to John Mackey. He's the co-CEO and co-founder of Whole Foods and the author, co-author of Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business, written with Raj Sisodia. John, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on, Nick.
Okay. This book is in many ways a kind of summary statement of principles that you've been working out for years and continue to develop. But let's start by talking about what is conscious capitalism in its most concise definition.
Well, the most concise definition is that it's free enterprise capitalism engaged in more consciously.
Right. And so this is, I mean, people, I mean, it's not just happening. People are thinking about what they're doing.
Yes.
And, you know, and taking kind of responsibility for everything that's going on.
Yes.
You talk in the book, I mean, there's a pyramid with four parts in it, you say, or the four tenets of conscious capitalism: higher purpose, conscious leadership, conscious culture and management, and stakeholder integration.
Correct.
Let's talk about those, and then we'll go to some specific examples. But when you say a business that is exhibiting or practicing conscious capitalism has a higher purpose, what do you mean by that?
I mean, it has a purpose beyond just making money.
Mm-hmm.
I think the critics of capitalism have got it in this very small box, that it's all about money. It's basically greedy and selfish and exploitative. And yet, I haven't found it to be that way. I mean, I've known hundreds of entrepreneurs, and with very few exceptions, most of them did not start their businesses primarily to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with making money.
Right.
My body, I can't live unless it produces red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
No red blood cells, I'm a dead man. But that's not the purpose of my life, to produce red blood cells. Similarly, a business cannot exist unless it's profitable. It can't innovate, it can't evolve, it can't meet competitive challenges, it can't even repair its equipment unless it's profitable. So profit's necessary. But just as doctors, they're very well compensated in our society, but they're purpose is not to make money. Their purpose is to heal people.
So you're saying that, I mean, just as a doctor, if they could make more money being a lawyer or an Indian chief, they wouldn't switch to that. Most entrepreneurs and most good businesses, most great businesses, I mean, you are not going to switch to something that has a higher return on investment simply because you could make more money doing it.
Correct. Exactly.
And you write in the book, great companies have great purposes. You talk about the purposes can vary from being the good, the true, the beautiful, the heroic. What is Whole Foods' higher purpose?
We have several higher purposes, and it's evolved over time. I mean, when we started the business, our higher purpose was very simple. It was basically to sell healthy food to people, earn a living for ourselves, and have fun. Now, as the business has grown, our purpose has evolved along with it. But usually when I try to articulate one higher purpose, I say that part of our higher purpose is to help heal America, because we're now 69% overweight, 36% obese, and 80% of what we spend on healthcare or for lifestyle diseases such as heart disease, stroke, diabetes, autoimmune diseases, and cancer, which correlate very closely with diet and lifestyle. So by educating people about the principles of healthy eating and selling them healthy foods, we think we're helping people to avoid these diseases and live longer.
And that's something that built up over time, because as you were saying,
yes,
that's not what, when you started this in
Correct.
Austin in a kind of ramshackle storefront, that's not what you were thinking, but it's moved towards that.
Yeah, I mean, just as we grow as human beings over time, our own sense of who we are evolves, so can a business's sense of what it is and why it exists evolve over time as well. I think as a business begins to pursue higher purposes, It helps align all these stakeholders together, and it helps the business to, I think, to be more successful, which is one of the reasons we articulate why it's important that business should seek its higher purpose beyond making money. And the good, the true, and the beautiful by Plato, I mean, these are timeless ideals. And business is fundamentally a human activity that humans engage in. Why shouldn't that also be in the pursuit of the highest ideals humans have ever articulated?
Well, and talking about stakeholders, that's one of the other tenets of capitalism, which is stakeholder integration. And I think this is from people on the kind of traditional or conventional free market right or side. this is where sometimes they think some of the things you're saying sound dangerously communistic.
Right.
Stakeholders as opposed to shareholders. And you actually, you write, you talk about stakeholders as the essence of the company. And that stakeholders include shareholders, but you also talk about investors versus speculators, loyal, trusting customers, inspired team members, patient, purposeful investors, collaborative, innovative suppliers, flourishing, welcoming communities, the environment as a stakeholder. Talk a little bit about stakeholders and, you know, what is the nesting order of stakeholders as the essence of a conscious capitalist company?
Well, I think one of the reasons people, libertarians and maybe conservatives, have a problem with stakeholders is that they, to a certain extent, distrust that this is just some trick to screw the stockholders.
Mm-hmm.
The stockholders are, you know, they get paid last. Customers get paid as soon as they exchange with the business. Employees get paid every couple of weeks. Suppliers get paid every 30 days. The government gets paid whenever it wants to. And only the stockholders get paid if there's anything left over. And that's usually not that much in most businesses. So I think that distrust is somewhat warranted. But of course, what we mean by stakeholders is simply recognizing that for a business to flourish, you have to create value for all of those stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
And a simple example I like to use as a grocery retailer is that our job as management of Whole Foods is to find and hire the very best people we can, make sure they're well trained in their jobs, and then help them to be happy, help them to flourish. Because we found when our team members are happy, they give better service to our customers. That helps the customers to be happy.
Right.
That creates loyalty, commitment to our stores. They spread the word to their friends, and the business is successful. That results in happy investors. So happy team members results in happy customers, which results in happy investors.
Right.
You've got suppliers that you're exchanging with you voluntarily that create competitive advantage. So all of these stakeholders are interdependent on one another, and the conscious business recognizes that, and so it consciously creates value for all of them, because then you're managing the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
You're helping the whole system to flourish, and that helps the investors to flourish.
And I mean, in a lot of ways, this is what you're talking about in the shift from a kind of industrial revolutionary style capitalism to a conscious capitalism, is that shift from individual actors or firms to more of a holistic model, that we're in an ecosystem.
Well, they're both.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, human beings are both individuals, and yet we're members of communities.
Right.
Some of those are voluntary, through common interest, or we join companies and we join those communities. Other we're born into, our families, our nation, our tribes, so mm-hmm. to speak. So I think we need to recognize that we're fundamentally individuals mm-hmm. and we're members of communities, and we shouldn't sacrifice individuals for the communities, but neither should we ignore the communities. We
right.
need to have both flourish.
You know, to talk about stakeholders too, I mean, you talk about the outer circle of stakeholders, and at one point in the book, you talk about troubles or issues that Whole Foods for years has had with unions, and you specific, now the unions and government to a certain degree are regulators or stakeholders in that they have something to say about businesses, whether or not they're adding to it. Talk a little bit about your example in Madison, Wisconsin with a union, where unions got into a Whole Foods. Generally, the stores are not organized, and you would argue that they're not organized because the workers don't want them. They're getting the best deal that they could. Talk about the Madison, Wisconsin experience you detail in the book, and how that allowed you to kind of think more about how to improve your relationships with the workers or team members.
One of the important things to understand, a couple things to understand. One is that, of course, unions often say that we prevent them from unionizing, which is a lie. They're legally protected. Employees can choose union representation if they wish. If they don't choose it, then they should have the right not to choose it. And in the case of Madison, this happened back in the year 2002, an isolated store, kind of out there, one store in Madison, away from the regional base in Chicago. And we ended up with a bad store team leader there. And we weren't paying enough attention to the declining morale survey scores that we got. So we could see in hindsight that the morale was declining, but the regional leadership didn't do anything about it. And then of course we had some organizers hire in for the summer with the express intent to organize the store, and they were successful. It was a close vote, but the union was voted in, and therefore we began to, quote, negotiate a contract with them. But no contract was ever signed. The union had made a lot of promises that they were not able to deliver on. And what interesting that happened was that it was such a wake-up call for me personally and the company as a whole. It's like, how could this happen? How could we must not be doing as good a job? Because in a way, the union is a competitor. They compete for the hearts and minds of your employees. And if people are fundamentally happy, they're not going to be a reason to select a union representation. If they're unhappy, then selecting a union is a good proxy indicator of that. So,
what were some of the things that you changed in response to the union making an inroad?
Well, one thing I did was I visited every store in the company over a year-long period, which was back then was about 150 stores. And I had dialogue after dialogue after dialogue with our team members about how we could make the company better. One of the things I heard consistently was, our health insurance could be better. Our health insurance could be better. And what's wrong with it? Well, we don't have complete coverage of everybody, and people would talk about their frustrations with it. It wasn't simple enough. And we basically changed our health insurance plan to the system that we have today with a high deductible plan that covers all of our full-time workers automatically. And we put in a personal wellness account or health savings account that we donated money to that they could spend on their own. And that plan has been extremely very popular with our team members. Now, we could do that everywhere except for Madison because we were in negotiations there. So the team members at Madison love that health insurance plan, but they weren't allowed to have it until there was a contract signed. We improved our paid time off for people, increased our vacation benefit plan. And so we made these improvements based on the tour everywhere except for Madison. Meanwhile, the union was not really able to deliver on any of their promises. We negotiated with them in good faith, but their demands were fundamentally unreasonable.
So did they go away, and now is Madison back in the
yeah.
fold?
What ended up happening, Nick, was that the team members themselves, there are strict laws that prevent management from getting involved in any kind of decertification. Unions can organize you, but you can't actually work to decertify a union once they're in. It had to be, we couldn't help them in any way. When they would contact us, we want to get rid of this union, we had to be silent. So they figured it out on their own, and they chose to decertify themselves voluntarily about 12 months, which is as soon as you can do it. They decertified the union 12 months after they put it in. I mean, the activists had already left. Then you're just left with team members who were fundamentally, the union wasn't doing anything for them.
In your discussion of conscious leadership, you talk about the rise of feminine values, and feminine is kind of in quotes there because these are things that are typically associated with feminine values, caring, compassion, cooperation, things like that. What is gained by thinking about the feminine values that might be brought into play in a business environment?
We need a different kind of leadership to manage these conscious organizations in the 21st century. If your leadership's not very conscious, you're not going to have a very conscious company because they will sabotage it. They will be threatened by it and they will just basically shut it down. So by conscious leadership, we generally mean leaders with a higher degree of emotional intelligence, higher degree of spiritual intelligence.
Again, this is something where when you think of like the conventional histories of titans of business, you don't think about Andrew Carnegie's emotional intelligence or his feminine values or, you know, John D. Rockefeller.
Different era.
Yeah, and so, you know, when you're saying, you know, we need different leadership, this is, we don't need the person who is issuing orders from on high? How does servant leadership play into
Well,
things?
A servant leader is someone, if you think about oftentimes the motivations in the past why somebody would want to be a leader, they might have a strong lust for power. They basically like to boss people around. Still attracts people into certain governmental bureaucracies. They basically like to throw their weight around. And secondly, they might be attracted to it for the money. So either sort of a military power or mercenary wealth. Arguably, the servant leader is more motivated by purpose, by serving the organization, by taking, just like a parent might want their children to flourish, and the parent serves their children. So in a conscious business, a conscious leader serves the organization. It helps the organization to reach its highest potential. It puts the good of the organization first.
Who are some leaders, that are out there now or in the past that you think provide good models of this type of servant leadership?
Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines is a great example.
And he's fascinating because he's not the type, you know, it's interesting, you wouldn't say, okay, well, he's got a lot of feminine values because he's an old style kind of cigar chomping or cigarette smoking old line businessman. But in fact, he created a radically different way of doing, of flying people.
Herb has a remarkable degree of emotional intelligence, and I would argue spiritual intelligence as well. And he's a servant leader. He may like to drink and smoke, but that doesn't have anything to do ultimately with leadership. That has to do with your own personal attitudes towards pleasure and health, I suppose.
You also talk about in conscious leadership that the leaders of an organization, I mean, they supply the vision or they help develop the vision. And, you know, that you learn through adversity. And you talk about the conflicts they had in 2007 with the Federal Trade Commission as well as the Securities and Exchange Commission. And how did that help you? I mean, you talk a lot about how what you did as a leader is you went and looked inward as you were going through some difficulties.
Sometimes we get in situations in life where we're under a lot of stress, it's a crisis, and our skill set that we know how to do is inadequate for the situation. The normal reaction for most people when faced with that is basically some type of contraction. Try to go back to some safe place where it won't be so painful, they won't be so afraid. In my experience, you should do exactly the opposite. And under a type of stress, instead of contracting backwards, you should open wider.
And at this point in 2007, you were merging with Wild Oats.
Right.
That was being held up by the FTC, and then an SEC commission investigation, which ended up finding you blameless.
Yeah, the FTC leaked out that I'd been posting on the internet. And I've been doing it for 8 years under a screen name, which is like going to a Halloween party and wearing a costume, which is the custom that you do at a Halloween party, and the custom you do at a financial bulletin board is take a screen name on. And out of 1,400 posts, I did have a few that were critical of Wild Oats, although be it almost a year before we actually began to negotiate with Wild Oats. And the media just sensationalized that and made it into a big deal. The next thing I know, I was being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission for perhaps I was giving away inside information. That came to nothing, and they ended up dropping their lawsuit. But
you
just
were
the
also,
accusation of it was damaging.
And you were also, I mean, that was in the media a lot. Okay, well, Mackey's done at Whole Foods. This is problematic.
Yes. I couldn't defend myself.
And, legally, you were not allowed to comment.
It was very painful. When you're being smeared and without any opportunity to write, be interviewed like we're being right now, or in any way get your story out there.
So what did you do? I mean, talk about what you discuss in the book of like how you grew, and then how does that, you know, how does that affect the organization? Because is it just you in a room somewhere doing, you know, yogic breathing, or how does it grow out into the organization?
Of course, as far as the organization was concerned, for almost a year, I was doing little but talk to lawyers. It was undoubtedly the most unpleasant episode in my 34-year career with the company.
And I assume in a lot of ways one of the most unproductive, because if you're talking to lawyers,
just wasting time talking to lawyers, going over all these posts that I had written in a spirit of play to see what the hidden meanings of it might be. So that was very unpleasant. I mean, I thought about quitting more than once. And I mean, I did some stuff that, I meditated more. I've always been a meditator, and I did more and deeper meditations. I also did something that I'd done many times before as well, but it had been several years. I did something called holotropic breath work, where you're basically, with a guide, you're basically just simply doing continuous deep breathing. And I can't really tell you exactly why this happens. I suspect it has something to do with the extra oxygen that you're bringing into your system that activates certain parts of your brain that generally you can't access or close down to it. Couldn't access except for perhaps through some type of hallucinogenic drugs. But the actual deep breathing exercises, yoga breathing can do the same thing, pranayama, with a guide enabled me to get really deep into who I was, what my motives were, what my purpose was. And I kind of reconnected with my purpose in life, what I was trying to do, and also how I needed to grow and evolve if I was going to continue to stay in charge of Whole Foods Market. I actually went through this process where I was having this dialogue, I think, with my higher self, asking whether I was prepared to step up. and it put these conditions. Were you willing to do this? Are you willing to do this? Are you willing to do this? And I kept saying yes, yes, and yes. And then when that process was over and I completely embraced what I think is my higher purpose in life, it all cleared up just like that. I mean, the SEC dropped their investigation like a week later.
But now that's not because, I mean, it's not some kind of karmic shout out.
I have no idea.
Yeah, but it worked out.
All I'm saying is whether that's coincidental or causal, who can say? The world is, life is a very bizarre thing. I assure you that there's many weird things happening.
Well, now let's talk about the fourth tenet, which is conscious culture and management. And leadership and management are distinct in your conception of things. And talk about what's in a conscious capitalist firm, conscious culture, what does that mean? And how is it different in your telling than, say, you know, when you talk to people who worked for IBM, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, there was a very conscious culture. I mean, a very rigid culture that everybody knew and everybody participated in. Salesmen wore navy blue suits and you know, a white shirt and a red tie, brown shoes or whatever. Brown shoes were not allowed, etc. Everything went through a chain of command, this and that. So there's a lot of businesses, and the great kind of post-war businesses, AT&T, GM, you know, Xerox, had a conscious culture. But you're talking about it in a different way. How is it different?
Well, what we mean by that is we need to create cultures that really allow the employees of the organization to fully flourish, for them to be happy, for them to be able to self-actualize themselves, reach their highest potential they can. The conscious business knows that ultimately its employee base is it's if you have an engaged employee base that's enthusiastic and happy, and you're going to get lower turnover, you're also going to get more innovation and more creativity. So you need to design cultures that really allow the business to reach its highest potential.
How do you get it where it's just workers or team members or, you know, employees or, you know, the people that you work with, that you collaborate with, aren't like, well, you know what, I don't really want to be in the food business. I want to start doing something else. And how do you give people enough space where they can develop and actualize themselves, but where they just don't start going off in different directions?
Sometimes they do go off in different directions. I mean, some people, you might say, play with us at Whole Foods for a year or two, and then they go off and become journalists, or hitchhike around the world, or start their own businesses. We get a lot of young people who don't necessarily know who they are or what their life's about yet. I mean, we have very low turnover rates, under 10% voluntary turnover per year, which for retail is extremely low.
Mm-hmm. But you do talk a lot about, part of the kind of tenet of conscious culture and management does have to do with decentralization and empowerment.
Right.
So, I mean, you're actually, in a way, and again, this is very different than kind of old style, you know, heavily hierarchical corporations, where you let people make decisions. You not only tell them to make decisions, but you actually give them the ability to act out on those.
One way to think about what's happened, Nick, is that the old management structure, the traditional management structure, was, what metaphors did it have? It had, for large-scale enterprise, it had the military, which is very hierarchical command and control. It had the church, also very hierarchical command and control. And then in the Industrial Revolution, you had the metaphor of the factory and the assembly line. And so basically, the human element was organized that way as well.
And that they were all basically the same. I mean, they were treated the same.
Exactly. This system worked relatively well for a while because you had economies of scale to it. You had people might have been cogs in an industrial machine, but the machine itself was awesome in terms of what had come before it.
Right.
But now as we get into the 21st century and we're connected together, we're much better educated, we've moved up kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, people don't want to be cogs in the machine anymore. That's just not, it's dehumanizing.
Right.
It just,
and they don't even want to be cells in the body, right? I mean, it's that metaphor doesn't even quite do justice.
Well, we don't know exactly what it's like to be a cell in a body.
Right.
It may not be, you could argue that I've got 100 trillion cells, they're all voluntarily cooperating for mutual benefit.
I know many of mine disappoint me on a regular basis and don't follow.
Fortunately, you
orders,
can get rid of those.
Yes, I hope. Well, talk in, you go into an episode in your Hartford store in 2007 where you talk about how you were faced with certain issues and, you know, kind of building a conscious culture and management helped get out of that. Talk a little bit about that.
We lost power in a store and it was in a very busy time. And so
it was a snowstorm was coming or something like that.
Exactly.
So people were rushing there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then your cash registers go out.
Yeah. We lost power. Yeah. Cash registers went out. And so the store team leader was off that day. And so the associate store team leader who was there just made a decision. It's like, okay, this was right, I think, near Christmas as well. So that store team leader just said, until we get power back online, all the people, when they got to the registers, we just let them take the food for free. We didn't make an announcement that said, it's all free, but we didn't charge anybody anything. And several thousand dollars that day were basically gifted out to our customers. But I mean, it wasn't their fault, right? Why should they be punished? And they want to just get home to their families. And so we just thought that was, that associate store team leader thought that was the right thing to do for our customers. And we teach the customers the most important stakeholder, do whatever is necessary to make the customer happy. Well, it's an interesting thing that happened. That was absolutely the right thing to do. Nobody ever second guessed that decision. But it had a happy ending to it, which is that it got picked up by the media. And the next thing we know, it's actually in the media, it gets picked up around the country. And people see that as an example of Christmas spirit. So the few thousand dollars of free groceries we gave away were more than compensated for by the tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars of goodwill and free publicity we got.
And it does showcase, I mean, I could see a lot of companies where they would be, you know, the person in charge would be totally freaking out or trying to get their boss on the line or their boss's boss to say, like, hey, is this okay?
Because they'd be afraid they'd get fired if they did that. What do you mean you gave the food away?
And you talk in the same chapter about Nordstrom's. Apparently Nordstrom has about the shortest employee guidebook. What is their one directive to their employees?
I think I have two guidelines. Guideline number one is use your best judgment in all situations.
Right.
And guideline number two is see number one.
Right.
In a sense, that's the ultimate empowerment. You're basically saying, we trust you, take care of our customers, do whatever is necessary for the customers to be
happy. And then how do you come back and evaluate that? Because obviously there are going to be times when employees, either through bad faith or good faith, you know, just make bad decisions. How do you come back and correct problems?
Well, you... if somebody makes a bad decision, you, so to speak, a teachable moment. You can use that example to educate them. But you don't want to punish people for, when they're taking care of your customers, you don't want to punish people for that. You're basically sending the exact wrong message to the organization. You basically want to reward people for taking care of your customers. And if they have a mistaken judgment in a very non-public way, you might say, we appreciate your intention here, but maybe next time in the future you might want to do this instead.
Yeah.
That conversation could occur.
Do you have a lot of discussion with your board of directors, or how long did it take to get your board of directors to fully both buy into your, you know, and I realize it's a kind of feedback loop, but how long did it take to find, you know, major investors who were not speculators, who were not like, okay, what are you doing for me next quarter?
Well, those are different things. You're talking about our board, you're talking about our shareholders. Yeah. Which one do you want to talk about?
Let's talk about the board first and then shareholders.
Well, the board has been evolving for decades, right? We've been a public company for 21 years now. So for the longest time as the entrepreneur, I used to just ignore the board. It's like, okay, we got to have a board. So what?
Yeah.
But over time, perhaps because I almost got fired back in the year 2000, I began to wake up to the reality that I've got to take the board very seriously.
And it's not just because they could fire you, but also because they were a storehouse of information and knowledge.
Well, they weren't aligned with, back then, they weren't necessarily aligned with the values of Whole Foods Market. They were just more traditional on a lot of traditional corporate values. So. Very careful then of educating our board, and also in, whereas management can't choose the board, that's done by the board itself and voted by the shareholders, we would vet them and we'd give our feedback about we like her better than him.
Yeah.
These are the reasons why, and generally our opinions would be taken into consideration. So I do think you need your board aligned with your higher purpose. And Whole Foods' board currently is.
And then shareholders as well. I mean, are they a different breed of investor, you know, where they're willing to say, okay, you know what, we've had a couple of bad quarters, but we get where you're going.
That's a little trickier. We are a public company, so we have thousands and thousands of shareholders, and they could be all over the map in terms of what they want. It's like our customers are very diverse as well.
Yeah.
But what we've done is we've cultivated long-term investors that there you can recognize after a while that some institutional investors really do mean it when they say we buy and hold for at least 5 years. And those are the investors that we really want to invest in our company. Those who are basically day traders or in or out, we don't encourage them to be investors in our stock. And the best way to do that is to just be transparent about what you're doing. Here's who we are, here's what we're gonna do. We're always gonna make decisions that are in the best long-term interest of our shareholders, even if it hurts us in the short run. And the speculators may stay away from us as a result of that. So they don't always do that. As our stock has traded up, they start to pile in.
And you've been able to maintain a very strong position even through a pretty rotten economy for a long time. Do you attribute that to a kind of long-range planning mentality?
I attribute it to, we're not really long-range planners, but I do attribute the loyalty that a lot of our institutional shareholders showed to us during that big financial crisis.
Right.
As testament to the fact that we had done a good job of communicating to them who we were, what we were trying to accomplish, and most of them did not cash out. They just said, you know what, we know you're gonna bounce back. These are macro environmental events beyond your control. Don't lose faith and stay the course.
You also, shifted some of your product offerings and whatnot to have a wider range of varieties.
We did two things during the financial crisis. One is that we recognized people were much more value conscious. Everybody was hunkering down. We didn't know if we were going into a depression or not. And so everybody stopped spending. The whole retail sector, not just Whole Foods, virtually everyone except for maybe Walmart, saw a decline in sales. So we had to put value front and center, and that's actually been good for us. We had not taken it as seriously perhaps as we should, and we started taking it seriously, and that was that's really helped us as the economy began to recover. Secondly, we decided, you know what, we need to, besides working on the value side of things and our pricing, we also need to continue to differentiate. How do we create space between us and our competitors? If they can copy us and then sell at a cheaper price, we're not in a good competitive
right.
situation. We can match their prices on things that are the same and innovate in ways that we create products they don't have. Then we've got the best of both worlds.
What is the basic route of that discovery process for innovation? Is that coming from, is it that people not associated with Whole Foods come to you and say, hey, here's something really cool? Is it regional parts of the company coming up? You know, this seems to be doing well here. All of the above?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's your suppliers. Sometimes it's innovations that occur at a store level that work. Like when I tell the story in the book about this store in Santa Rosa, California that opened up a taproom bar. Mm-hmm. Which when I first heard about it, I thought that's a bad idea. A bar and a grocery store? Who's gonna go to a supermarket for a bar? But it turned out to be hugely successful. So the point is, the store was empowered
right.
to do the experiment. If it failed, they wouldn't have been punished. We would have just reallocated the capital, but they didn't fail. They were hugely successful. Now I think last count we had 85 bars now across the company, not again commanded by Austin, but simply by stores imitating what they first saw and
right.
improving upon it.
What are the external forces? So you've got your kind of pyramid of conscious capitalism. What are the forces that are external to that, whether it's the government, whether it is, global economic shifts? What are the toughest hurdles that you're facing that are not within your pyramid?
Obviously the most difficult challenge Whole Foods faces, as every business faces, is that we don't have any patents. We're a retail
right.
company, so anything we do, our competitors can study it, copy it, and they generally do study it and copy it. We're very innovative, and then they just try to sell it cheaper. So this forces us, pay attention to price, but also to continue to innovate. So we continue to innovate quicker than they can imitate. But as
there particular regulatory issues that you're facing, or government issues where, the government in a way is a stakeholder, but it's
yeah.
also it's a stakeholder that is in the body of an 800-pound gorilla, where there's not much dialoguing going on necessarily. Is that an issue?
Well, we face a lot of government regulations at all levels, from local to state to federal, depending on what we're talking about. You've got lots of regulations regarding the number of hours you can employ people. Let's take California, for example, which is consistently rated the worst place to do business in America, which has been my experience is true. You can't even, used to be in most states, you don't hit overtime, for example, until somebody works more than 40 hours in a week. In California, you hit overtime when somebody works more than 8 hours in one day. So you couldn't have a flexible shift where somebody says, I only want to work 4 days a week, I want to work 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
No, we'd be paying 32 hours of regular time and 8 hours of overtime, a time and a half, so of course we're not going to allow that to occur. But the team member might want that, it might work better with their life, and we might want that too, but we're not allowed to because the government regulations really prevent it or penalize you severely if you do it.
Are those old-style kind of regulatory regimes, are they fading, or are they just a cost of doing business where even though you're guaranteeing higher level cleanliness or treatment of the products that you're producing, you just got to deal with that because they're not going away?
They're not going away, and they can be extremely difficult. Let's take what claims you can make in your meat department. You generally have to get permission. We had to get permission from the government before we did our animal welfare rating program. We couldn't just say, we've created this system, we're going to rate animals on their wellness, and here's what we're doing. No, the government had to sign off on all of our language and everything we said. We had to get permission before we did it.
At what level, the federal government?
Federal government, the U.S. USDA. Department of Agriculture has a division dedicated to meat claims, so we weren't allowed to make any claims that they hadn't approved of, which means the government can approve it, that means they can also change their minds.
Right.
And we're fortunate so far they haven't, but they could.
Do you have a sense, I mean, there seems to be a vast amount of uncertainty in the regulatory world, in the economic world, in the global marketplace. Is that level of uncertainty, and it's we haven't even had a federal budget in years. I mean, is this something that is really weighs on you, or is that just something that you can't spend time worrying about?
It doesn't weigh on us in terms of the business because we can't do anything about it. I mean, we're very concerned about a lot of the healthcare. They're going to raise the cost of coverage for employers. That's just, they already have.
I mean, what will be your response to that? Do you take, if the increase in healthcare goes up, do you take it out of people's wages? Do you hire fewer people? Do you raise prices and hope to make up the difference?
I think initially what will happen, not just for Whole Foods, but for virtually every company out there that's got more than 50 employees, they give you an escape clause, which is if they work less than 30 hours, you don't have to insure them. You're going to see a lot of people working 29 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Whole Foods is very proud of the fact that 75% of our team members work full-time, more than 30 hours a week, and we cover them for health insurance. But if they keep driving the cost of insurance up, and our competitors are going more and more part-time, if we're going to compete, we may be forced to do something very similar ourselves, which wouldn't be in the interest of our team members, our customers, or our investors, none of our stakeholders. But of course, the government comes in and says, well, now we're going to make it 20 hours a week. At that point, health insurance will keep gaining in terms of the pool of money available to pay wages and benefits. Health insurance will keep gaining at the expense of the other one. So your wages over time will be less. And so if you, like President Obama wants to keep increase the minimum wage, it won't affect Whole Foods, we pay better than that. But if you raise the minimum wage for some companies and are forcing health insurance on it, inevitably that creates more unemployment as they seek labor-saving devices, for example, or they reorganize themselves to not have the labor, more self-service, or you automate certain things, it ends up increasing unemployment. As we know this happens. You raise the minimum wage and youth unemployment goes up. It's just inevitable.
Well, talk a little bit about the larger forces that are, that work against conscious capitalism kind of developing as quickly as you might want it to.
I mean, I think the biggest kind of macro thing that prevents it is just basic skepticism that people have a belief that, oh, this sounds all very good, but in the real world where it's tough competition, this isn't going to work. And we think that's a myth, but there's kind of a macho culture out there in the business world that says, only the paranoid survive, nice guys finish last, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. There's lots of
And your co-author in particular has written books about companies that flourish as good places to work. I mean,
exactly.
That are clearly part of this. Well, let's end it with,
That's why I think conscious capitalism, Nick, is ultimately going to spread. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work better, if it ultimately doesn't create more value for investors and for other stakeholders, I've written a very interesting book that won't have any legs to it.
Right.
But I don't think that's the case. I really do think these ideas are going to triumph over the long term because they're going to be adopted by young entrepreneurs, and they're going to succeed in the marketplace, and the businesses that are more conscious are going to outcompete the less conscious businesses over time. And if I'm wrong about that, then these ideas won't amount to anything. I don't think I'm wrong, though.
It's interesting throughout the book and throughout your work practice. I mean, there's this sense of where these diametrical oppositions that we take for granted, management versus labor, work versus pleasure, et cetera, I mean, they all seem to be kind of collapsing. And you talk in the book about how millennials, for instance, don't necessarily think of work as something that you suffer through, but rather it's part of the purpose of life. So that, we'll see this in, we seem to see this in entrepreneurs among younger people to begin with.
Yes. I mean, one of the things we emphasize in the book that sometimes, it's a key idea, but hard for people to grasp. We talk about different kinds of intelligences, and the type of intelligence that we're trained in school, which many people never master, the basic analytical intelligence, the kind of intelligence that our IQ tests measure, which allows us to compare and contrast. And that type of intelligence generally thinks in terms of trade-offs. They're always asking, well, how do you balance this? If you do this, isn't there a trade-off there? That's really the analytical mind. That's the way it sees things. It carves things up into its parts. In the conscious business, where you need a high analytical intelligence, you also need what we call systems intelligence. The ability to see the whole system, to be able to see the relationships that exist between all these parts. So in the conscious business doesn't think so much in terms of trade-offs. It's looking for innovative solutions that avoid the trade-offs and create these win-win-win-win scenarios. And that ends up being very, very effective in business competition.
Well, let's end with, I'd like to hear you comment a bit on one of the lines that I thought was particularly memorable in the book, where you talk about life, life and business and whatnot. It's the journey is joyful, but not easy. What are you getting at with that?
I've been following my heart since I was 19 years old, and creating Whole Foods has been the most fun thing I've ever done, except when I was talking to lawyers back in 2008. It's been a lot of fun because it's creative. I mean, I've been able to be highly creative, kind of in a flow state for most of my career. And you're a writer, you're a creative type. And so you know that when you're creating, life is kind of at its peak sparkle. Well, business, being an entrepreneur, is a form of creativity. You're creating something. You're watching it grow, you're watching it evolve. That's fundamentally joyful.
Right. Even when you're facing difficulties, it could be bankruptcy, it could be legal proceedings, just failure, you can be joyful in pursuing what you want.
I mean, it's not every instant of your life is joyful, but you have more joy than you have pain. But it's like what I'm told, I'll never experience this myself, but apparently childbirth is extremely painful for women, but they seem to also have a lot of joy in it, and they have a lot of joy in raising their children. So is it worth it? Only each individual has to decide that for themselves. There is a great deal of joy in being an entrepreneur and building a business. There's also some pain. There's also risk, and there's sometimes failure. And that just they're a package deal, kind of like life.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you, John Mackey. We've been talking with John Mackey, the co-CEO and co-founder of Whole Foods and the co-author of Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business, which you co-wrote with Raj Sisodia. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Nick.